Hello and welcome to today's Visitor Else podcast. I hope whatever you're doing, you have had a great day. Or maybe it's the morning. I hope your day goes very well. Anyway, in today's podcast, I am bringing you Larry Bush, who's the Managing Director of Noah's Ark Zoo Farm. Noah's Ark Zoo Farm is in North Somerset, for those of you who don't know, but it's grown significantly over the past 15 years. Today it has over 200,000 visitors per year, 20,000 school children. It really is so huge. This former family-owned dairy farm has now turned into a charity, as the Bush family appreciate this is more than just a family business. It's now a place for the future of wildlife education, conservation and people. I chatted to Larry about his journey to joining the family business in 2019, which included bringing an extremely popular food product into the UK. You'll be surprised at what he was doing before. Anyway, the focus of our conversation is around their Visit England Gold Award for inclusion and accessibility. And with 40% of all households having someone with an impairment or disability, this really needs to be regarded as a mainstream market, as people don't come alone, do they? They come in groups, and very often the needs of this person will affect their choice of where to go. It's also not as expensive to introduce accessibility into your organisation either. I'm sure many of you will know this. It's not just about the ramps and the toilets, although they do help massively. It's also about your customer service training and awareness. Larry has lots to share on what they've done and admits even though they have the award, they still have the complaints about what they're not doing. It's an ongoing project as people's needs are vast. I also chat to Larry about work experience and how they manage it at the zoo farm and his suggestions for anyone wanting to get a job working with the animals at a place like theirs. Larry is the son of the founders, Anthony and Christina Bush, who in their 60s decided to sell their herd and start this chapter in their lives, handing the reins over to Larry whilst in their 80s. It's amazing, because I'm sure many of you who've been around for a while will know and remember Anthony and Christina fondly. I mean, I remember them getting on stage at many an attractors forum to talk about their latest developments at the farm. And I don't think I realised or appreciated at the time how early on they were in their development of the attraction. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this podcast. It's a gem. Welcome to the Visitor Else podcast. My name is Kelly Ballard and I'm a specialist in marketing in the visitor economy. This podcast is all about sharing behind-the-scenes stories from inspiring businesses and people in tourism, hospitality, culture and events, and everything in between. Over the years, I've managed marketing strategies and plans for many destinations, attractions and hospitality businesses. I've worked with hundreds of people and organisations across Wales and the West, as well as promoting the area to the rest of the world. As a result, I've heard many inspiring stories. Our challenges are similar the world over, and sharing stories helps us connect, learn, and appreciate our industry in a different way. So get your notebook out, settle in, and enjoy. Today, I am joined by Larry Bush, who's the Managing Director of Noah's Ark Zoo Farm in between Clevedon and Bristol. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Larry.
Thanks for inviting me on, Kelly. It's a real pleasure to be on your podcast.
Well, I can't wait to hear more from you because I absolutely love Noah's Ark. My children are now 11 and 12, and since they were little, we've been coming there. And I don't know why, but we always seem to come in the winter. But they love it, and I've been looking at your website and looking at some of the figures that you've got, and you've got over 100 species of animals. You've got the largest elephant kind of space enclosure in the UK. But my children love it for the play area. So all of those educational important things that you've got, they are now, I guess as they're getting older, they just love coming for the slides. And in particular, they've always loved the one where you walk up the elephant's bottom and down his trunk. That's hilarious. You spend all your money on all of these amazing things, and yet it comes back to these very basic things, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. It sounds like a very familiar story, actually, Kelly. We have so many people who come here and the parents are bringing them to show them the elephants and the Andean bears. And actually, they just want to kind of go through the chicken walkthrough and go down the slides and spend all day in indoor play. So, yeah, that's great to hear that you've been here with the kids, though, and you've enjoyed it. And yeah, I think lots of people kind of drive by not really realizing kind of how much is here, and there is quite a good variety of things for people to enjoy, and play is definitely one of them.
Definitely. What I love about it is the year-round experience. I think your indoor play area and the, I want to call it the petting zoo, it's probably got a better name than that, but it's fantastic, that area that you've got with the like auditorium where you get the animals out and you talk. That is really, really good. And so if it's raining, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think the indoor areas, they're like in Aladdin's cave, aren't they? Because they're old farm barns that they used to be, you know, cattle would be in there, be hay barn areas, and they've been kind of converted into these huge, great home built, a lot of them play areas with incredible drop slides. And there's like a three-dimensional beehive maze and all these really unique and surprising kind of play areas. And then, yeah, we've got the animal village in there where people can kind of meet the small mammals and guinea pigs and rabbits and all kinds. And then we've got this big arc arena, as you say, where we can have events. We actually use it for our team meeting once a week, and then education workshops. So even when it's pouring down with rain, this vast kind of indoor areas here, as well as there's 100 acres of outdoor space too.
Yeah, there's so much there. Well, look, I mean, today I wanted to get you on because I heard you speak at an event back last year, and I was fascinated by your story in terms of the story of the zoo itself, how you came to be where you are today. And also recently this year, you've won an award for accessibility and inclusion. I'd like to talk to you about that. You've also, I mean, you win lots of awards all the time, but these in particular, this was you won gold in the Visit England Accessible and Inclusive Tourism Award for Excellence, no less. So that was amazing. I thought that, I'd like to get your thoughts on that in a second. You were Work Experience Employer of the Year from Western College, which is no mean feat, because I think, you know, it's a real challenge supporting work experience in amongst the working day. So I'd like to talk to you a bit more about that. But yeah, I mean, for those, you've given a little bit of a highlight of what is Noah's Ark Zoo Farm today. But tell people, you know, what is it? How many visitor numbers do you have? What is on offer there that you haven't already mentioned?
Yeah, so Noah's Ark, we are a farm that turned into a zoo. So this is a family dairy farm. My family have been here for 60 years, and it was my parents that started it off for 20 years ago, just over 20 years ago. In the early days, it was very community orientated, a lovely kind of farm park, and then it's grown up very organically, kind of year by year, more animals being added. And so now it's actually really quite a big place. It's over 100 acres. We've got some really large exotic animals, including elephants and lions and giraffes and bears. So it's quite surprising. It's not what you'd expect to find on a normal dairy farm in Somerset, but it's now this really large, spacious zoo. And it's also got this brilliant adventure play. So we kind of think about having all three of those elements of kind of zoo, farm park, and play all in one place. And we are visited by over 200,000 people every year. We've got really quite a large team here, and we've got over 100 people that are employed here looking after the animals and looking after the visitors. So yeah, it's sort of grown up in this lovely sort of organic entrepreneurial way. Still has that very strong community vibe about it. And yeah, it's a lovely place to work. I think we're all feel very lucky to be part of the team here at Noah's Ark.
Yeah, I'm sure. I interviewed Sammy Luxer last year, because she started, I think she started as a summer job, didn't she? And she worked her way up to managing marketing. And yeah, she had such fond memories of working there. That's where she cut her teeth and working in the industry, really.
Yeah, Sammy did an amazing job here, and that's absolutely, you know, she grew with the zoo. And I think Noah's Ark has been a place where It's a very nurturing environment, and I think it's somewhere where we encourage people to develop their skills, and we sort of create opportunities for people to do that, really. And so part of that sort of learning culture is what it's something we value, and I value in running Noah's Ark. And so, yeah, Sammy's definitely one of our real success stories. He did an amazing job here and has gone to achieve incredible things at Slimbridge and with WWT. So, yeah, that's a familiar story, actually. Some people come for one reason and they end up leaving a different person.
Ah, that's really nice. Well, talking about coming for one reason and, well, still being there, tell me about your kind of journey into where you are today. Because, I mean, you said it was started by your parents, but I remember hearing a hilarious story of you didn't start in this industry, did you? And it wasn't your original ambition to go into the farm. Tell me about what you did as a young man and how you came to be where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely did not want to be a farmer. I kind of left home at 18, went off to university, and went into a career in business initially. I worked for Walker's Crisps for 10 years, and I was lucky to be part of a team that introduced Doritos to the UK.
No way.
So in fact, there's a TV series on Channel 4 at the moment called The Secret World of Crisps.
Yeah.
And I speak on that program about the kind of that experience of being part of the team introducing Doritos. And went off to America to learn all about Doritos and then introduced that to the UK market and then various different European markets. So so that was a kind of quite a sort of intense period of my career working for Walkers, which is part of PepsiCo, you know, high pressure, high stakes, but really fun as well, very youthful and lots of things happening. But I'd had a long-term ambition to really kind of use business for social enterprise, and I was very interested in fair trade, and I managed to find an opportunity to work in the fair trade movement. So I left Walkers to do that and ended up being a director of a fair trade organization, who were very instrumental, Tradecraft, who were very instrumental in fair trade becoming such a mainstream thing, because it's hard to think now, but going back sort of 15, 20 years, it was quite an edgy idea. It was, you know, big business was very suspicious of ethical things like fair trade, and business was, you know, very profit driven, didn't really think about social responsibilities and sustainability. So it was really exciting being part of that movement to bring ethical values to the fore with business. And so, I was helping to run that company, working with producers in some really difficult circumstances in many, many countries around the world, but also influencing the way mainstream businesses and retailers were gradually kind of supporting fair trade. So that was a sort of second stage of my career. The story that you referred to actually happened while I was working for Walkers, is that my dad phoned me up one day and said, "Would you mind taking a day off to meet some rhinos at the airport, at Stansted Airport?" I think we as a family have recognized that our parents are not sort of normal dairy farmers. They're quite unconventional and very entrepreneurial. But this was a phone call I didn't expect to have. All these sort of images raced through my mind of like rocking up at the airport with a sign saying Mr. and Mrs. Rhino this way. I arrived at the airport and it was, you know, it was the cargo part of Stansted, and there were all these amazing, you know, vets and animal professionals. And sure enough, these two big crates were unloaded from an aeroplane and covered in cargo netting, and it felt very Jurassic Park, actually, with these huge rhinos inside these crates. And I followed them down in the lorry, and they arrived at Noah's Ark. It was a very windy day, actually, and there was a huge crane that lifted the crates over the top of the brand new rhino house, and the kind of crates were swinging in the wind, and thankfully, they kind of landed safely on the other side, and the rhinos entered their new enclosure. And yeah, I think that was a big milestone for Noah's Ark. You could probably say that was the moment it became a zoo. Previous to that, there'd been things like ostriches and llamas and kind of slightly exotic animals, but this like rhinos, this is like a proper exotic animal.
Wow. So when did you become involved in the zoo? When did you decide that this is what you were going to do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it was sort of at the end of my time working in fair trade. I left that position and I worked freelance for a few years, actually. By that stage, I had sort of 25 years of experience. And I was helping various charities and social enterprises in the northeast of England, thinking about their strategy and marketing. And at that stage, my folks gave me a call and said, would I come and do a review with the team here at Noah's Ark? And I think when I came to do that, I could see that Noah's Ark had become really quite big. And it had been very much a family startup. No real sort of awareness of the kind of systems and ways of working that, you know, good-sized businesses need. So I could see that there were some changes that needed to happen in order to sort of adapt to the scale that Noah's Ark had achieved. And equally, it was a catalyst for some family conversations about succession, because my parents actually didn't start Noah's Ark until they were in their 60s. So by this stage, they were in their mid-80s.
Wow.
And they were absolutely loving it. And they you know, have done an amazing job in this place to have the courage to launch a new business and to grow such a big enterprise, especially at that kind of later stage of life. But I think they realized through talking it through that, you know, they we're not able to sustain that level of pressure and intensity too much longer. And so after, you know, quite a series of discussions amongst the family, we all agreed that it would be a good idea for myself to take on the running of the business. And at that stage, my parents still owned the business. And so I relocated with my family back down to Bristol, where I'd grown up, with my children were sort of at a stage of going off to university. So my son was actually quite horrified because he had just got a place at Bristol University. And he suddenly realized when we told him what was happening that his parents were moving in. He was trying to escape to the other part of the country. But we did reassure him that we weren't planning to rock up at the student union on a Saturday night, and he'd had plenty of his own space and independence.
Brilliant.
But yeah, it's been an amazing thing. It's something I never anticipated would happen, because it felt like I'd had my own completely separate kind of normal professional career. So the idea of kind of coming back to the family business and literally back to where I grew up on the farm wasn't something I planned. But yeah, it's been really fun and it's such a colourful job to do.
It is, isn't it? And I think, well, working in this industry is, but also what you do in terms of, you know, working in an attraction is amazing with animals. It's just people love it. I mean, there's obviously controversy surrounding people that don't, but it is such a lovely place to be in. So, I mean, just thinking about the business now, I mean, 200,000 visitors a year and 100 staff. Yes, that's a huge business to run, isn't it? And you're always thinking of new ways to get better, be better. And, you know, just thinking about the award that you've won recently, this Accessibility and Inclusion Award. You know, is that something that you've been always thinking about? How has that come about, and why is that important to you?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. It's come about for a number of reasons, and I think it's a lovely coincidence of a few different things coming together. I think one thing is that Noah's Ark has always been a very sort of caring, nurturing kind of environment for people as well as for animals. But for myself, coming into Noah's Ark, I had the experience of being a father of some children who'd had challenges growing up. I have a daughter who is autistic, and another daughter who had really suffered with kind of mental health challenges, had struggled with different stages of schooling. And I think that helped me to have an increased awareness of how challenging life can be for lots of people. And, you know, I kind of had that specific insight as a parent, but it gave me a glimpse of that kind of wider world of, so everyone's different and everyone's kind of facing different challenges of all kinds. And that was my perspective. Equally, within the team at Noah's Ark, a member of the team we had, Rhianne Gunstone, came from a special educational needs background. She was a teacher, and so she had a real professional expertise in this area, and she was aware of what could be done and what needed to be done, really, is for Noah's Ark to make us more accessible. And then I think the third thing is we as a team really believed this was something we wanted to focus on and make a real major focus on. And we had created a 5-year plan. We created a program called Ark for All. And we all had this sort of determination that we didn't know exactly what we needed to do, but we just really wanted to make Noah's Ark a welcoming place for as many people as possible, and that we would do whatever it takes to do that. And we sort of started that journey around about 2018. And we launched the project by doing some practical things. We created an inclusive playground, actually right next door to the elephant butt slide that you mentioned earlier on.
Is that what you call it? The elephant butt slide. That's hilarious.
So we had a lovely set of swings up there, and there's a roundabout that is inclusive in that you can easily, and anyone can enjoy using the roundabout, but it's easy to get a wheelchair onto it. It's easy for everyone to use. And then right beside it, we installed a changing places toilet, which is a real game changer for lots of people. They just can't go for a day out if there isn't a changing places toilet with a hoist. So that became our Ark for All hub.
And so, can I just stop you there, Larry? Just for those that don't know, what is a changing places toilet? Because I've heard this a lot and seen this a lot recently whilst I've been doing a bit of research. What is it?
Yeah, so it's an accessible toilet that goes further than a sort of disabled toilet, as they've traditionally been called. So that there's lots of space in it. It's really it's a large room. There's a toilet facility in there, but crucially, there's a hoist and there's a changing bed, so that some people adults need a hoist to be able to be changed by their carers, because of the nature of their disability. And without that, people are faced with like having to like lie on the floor and be changed in a toilet that's, you know, on a cold floor. And this is the reality for lots of people. If they're going for a day out, if there isn't a changing places toilet, they're, you know, put through that horrible ordeal. And I think once you're aware of that, you know, I think every attraction would want to install a places toilet. And incredibly, there aren't actually that many around. So lots of people, they're excluded from going to lots of places when there isn't that kind of facility. I think for us, it's an example of how we've learned so much by talking to people. And really, the progress we've made with the Ark for All program is by being willing to learn and willing to listen. And we've been guided by our customers and members and people who we've engaged with, who've kind of said, actually, you could really do with changing places toilets, or you could do with a better hearing loop system. We've really been led by the experts, whether it's kind of people who need those facilities or other organizations. And so what we've brought to the party is the desire to improve, and the determination to, install new facilities, improve our physical infrastructure. But I think almost as important as that is to create that culture of wanting to be welcoming, genuinely wanting to be welcoming, and have training happening. Lots of it's free training. There's so much available. We've done the Dementia Friends training. We enrolled in the Sunflower Lanyard Scheme, and all of these kind of organizations provide free training in lots of cases. So, I think it's been a journey that we just kind of were determined to do that. And we had no idea this was going to end up with kind of a national award. That isn't at all why we've done it, but it's been an encouraging sort of milestone on that journey to kind of feel like we're making progress. Still so much we want to do. I think we kind of feel really keen to share the experience that we've had with others. There's some other brilliant work going on. talking about WWC Slimbridge. They also received the national award for what they've done in accessibility and inclusivity. There's some great work going on, particularly here in the West Country, actually, this area. So we're kind of keen to share those experiences and kind of highlight the good reasons to do it. That it kind of just helps you be a better welcoming place, actually, just by doing these things.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? And I think having worked for many years in this industry, I don't know, it's ignorance probably that you see it as a minority group. But actually, when you look at the figures, 40% of UK households have someone in the house with a form of disability. And 75% of families have turned away from a business when they didn't have the right facilities. And I mean, it's huge. It's 20% of all day visits, according to Visit England, were made by someone with an impairment. And 16% of all domestic overnight visits had someone in the group with an impairment. This is a massive market, isn't it? Let's be, you know, crude about this. But also, it's about welcoming. You come as a family group. And it's not just one person. So this is about what you do as a family. And if 40% of your families have somebody in the group that needs, you know, extra care, then it's really important that that's provided, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, those are incredible stats, aren't they? And I think we often think about a sort of typical family visiting Noah's Ark. And, you know, it's so common that maybe one of the children is autistic. Maybe one of the parents has special dietary requirements, and quite probably one of the grandparents needs a mobility scooter to get around. You know, that we can probably all relate to that. That's a very kind of typical group of visitors to the zoo. So as you say, this isn't about, you know, tiny minorities of people. This is really just being welcoming to, you know, all the groups that turn up. And you'd almost kind of flip this on the idea of accessibility. You'd flip it on its head and saying, if you're not doing that, you're actually being quite exclusive. You're excluding whole proportions of the population. They can't really enjoy a day out with you if you don't provide this stuff. So I think we are in that process of social change, you know, as a society.
Yeah.
And within the visitor economy, we're kind of reflecting that you have to do this stuff. If you want to be, you know, a good welcoming place, you really do need to embrace being accessible. And the nice thing is, I think some people feel a bit intimidated by it because if they don't feel they know what to do, they don't know what language to use. But what we really encourage people to do, and we definitely think this of ourselves, is like, we're really not experts at this. We are just trying to learn, and everybody is willing to tell us what we need to do to improve. And so you just have to kind of ask those questions and have that genuine learning approach and listen to the feedback and make small improvements. And you don't have to do it all at once as well. It's a step-by-step journey. So it's not something to feel worried about or intimidated about. But yeah, it's great to sort of embrace that and be led by your customers.
Mm. And I was listening to something the other day, and they were saying there's a perception that it's expensive to make these adaptions and kind of, you know, support this visitor more. But actually, that's the compliance element to it, isn't it? It's the kind of like, that's the physical assets that you need to change. Whereas actually, you've mentioned it in terms of customer service elements to that and being kind of aware of what people's needs are as they come in, all the different needs. So it's about training staff to be aware of all of these things, isn't it? Which doesn't take that huge amount of investment. It's just training, essentially.
Absolutely. I think you're spot on, Kelly. The training and the culture are the most powerful parts of it. And I think that just comes from a willingness and a desire to be more welcoming and be more inclusive and embrace all the kinds of visitors that come. And actually, visitors are really understanding. People they understand that you can't, the attractions can't have all the facilities at once. They really do. And you know, even though we won a National Gold Award, we look around the site and we look at all kinds of footpaths where we think, oh, that's still a bit rough, that's still a bit steep. There's so much that we know we still have to do to become more accessible. And so it's just kind of, it's not something you have to do all in one go. And, you know, each year we try and make improvements, but it depends from year to year what we can afford to do. but visitors are really understanding. But what they really do value is that desire to become more accessible and that willingness to genuinely listen to what can make your day more enjoyable. How can we help?
Mm. How do you do that out of interest, Larry? How do you kind of open your kind of emails and the like? Do you actively pursue that kind of feedback? How do you do it?
Yeah, we do. We take on board all the customer feedback and we read that. I will read the comments. We have a customer comments report every month. So all of my senior team will kind of really pore through the comments. And that's
how do you get them, Larry? How do you get them at the moment?
It comes through a mixture of things. Some of it is through Messenger and through social media. Some of it's through email. Some of it's captured through comments on site. We have a pretty close-knit team, so we have, you know, lots of informal reviews on a weekly basis where we'll kind of pool all the feedback. So, I mean, that includes all kinds of feedback, so not just things to do with accessibility, but we do the accessibility comments are a really useful source of feedback. And, you know, just to keep it real, you know, we're pretty proud of this kind of Visit England Gold Award that we've got, but we got absolutely slammed, you know, a few weeks ago by someone saying, you know, you've got this award up, but your accessibility is rubbish. You know, you need to improve these footpaths. So it's good to sort of earth yourself in the reality because every individual's got their own perspective and we need to, you know, listen to that. Mm. So yeah, we really kind of look at the individual comments. We also have really asked individual families for their help where we've got members and they've got members of the family with physical disabilities, for example. We've asked them to come in and do sort of tours around the zoo with them to get that kind of insight as to, well, how could we improve this area? And actually some of those facilities that we talked about with the inclusive play area were designed with one particular family where they kind of helped us choose the equipment and helped us think it all through and where to position a changing places toilet. So that's been really useful as well as another approach. And then we've worked with organizations. There is one charity called Hard Days Out with the Kids, and they've been brilliant. They particularly specialize in working with families where they have children with autism, autistic children, and they've kind of helped us to train our team and helped us think through things in terms of calm spaces. We've developed signage as well. And we have our own Rianne who has championed this area for us and has done a phenomenal job here at Noah's Ark. She developed a whole language of symbols that we use for our interpretation. And that was designed working with outside organizations who are going to, there's a language called Widget, which lots of people will know, but Widget doesn't really have all the detail of different zoo animals. So Rianne kind of took that further and she's designed our own version of Widget. And so we have now accessible signage across all of the animal enclosures. But what we found is that there is a sort of universal law, if you like, that if you make something like signage accessible for one group of people, you actually discover that it becomes accessible for everybody. And so this signage is really popular now for, you know, children of all ages. Lots of adults really love it as well because they say, well, I actually don't really want to read all the detail you have on your traditional pen signs, but I love this accessible signage because it's so visual and it's so engaging. So, yeah, I think that's one of the things we've learned along the way, that if you do make things accessible for one group of people, often you find it just works better for everybody.
Mm, absolutely. Changing the subject now, I want to talk to you about your charitable status that you've got in 2023. So tell me about that and your ambition, I guess, for the zoo.
Yeah, so the charitable status has been a journey to get there. It's taken really, I've been here 4 years now. It's taken all of that 4 years to gain charitable status. And it's something that my family kind of chose to do. My parents have donated the zoo into this charity, so they've given away that asset. And the reason that they wanted to do that, and we all want to do that as a family, is we feel that Noah's Ark has become something much bigger than a family business. It's something that we want to be shared and enjoyed, you know, for the public good forever. And so the charity has really provided the vehicle for that to happen. And the process of doing it has been to apply to the Charity Commission and kind of set out the aims of the charity. We've got four fantastic trustees on board who are independent, and all bring their really great, different, varied experiences. And the charity it's a conservation charity, and it also has education aims. And then the bit that's a little bit unique but reflects what we've been talking about with people is we've got a third aim, which is about human well-being. And that really kind of recognizes the value that lovely natural environments like this have to the well-being of people. And that really came across strongly, particularly kind of in the periods during the COVID lockdowns and in between. People were really enjoying coming to this space and telling us how much they valued being in this lovely kind of green oasis of calm that we have here, and the lovely valley that Noah's Ark is in, and being able to kind of connect with the wildlife and the animals. And so we've made human well-being a third aim, which is, I think, fairly unique for a zoo. I think most zoos would have conservation and education as their aims, but we've got this kind of really interesting third area. So that finally, we got the registration through about this time last year, to autumn, winter 2022. And then we went through the actual restructuring process, which I had no idea how complicated it was going to be, but like endless legal documents and financial arrangements. And finally, the transfer happened on the 4th of April this year, and Noah's Ark opened as a charity for the first time. So, yeah, it's a really exciting milestone for the zoo. I feel really excited about what it will do for Noah's Ark in providing a real kind of focus. And it's been really welcomed by staff. I think everybody loves the fact they're now working for a charity. And for visitors, they've welcomed it as well. We've had really good feedback, and already people are sort of topping up their admissions and opting in for gift aid, and yeah, really enjoying kind of supporting the charity.
Mm. Could I ask you quickly about your conservation kind of aims and objectives and what you do around that? Because I'm not really sure about that, to be honest with you. Tell me a bit more. Yeah. As I said, we spend most of our time in the slides. Yeah, terrible parent.
Well, it's not a bad thing to do. That's all about human well-being. So, yeah, I mean, the conservation aims, there's actually quite a few layers to it, because the zoo animals part of it, we have quite a number of endangered species, and we're members of multiple international breeding programs. So, for example, our spectacle bears are part of an international breeding program. We've got a fantastic facility with a cubbing den, and so we were allocated a breeding pair of bears, and they had cubs last year. So we've now got these twin bear cubs, and so that's really important, because Andean bears are very much vulnerable and endangered in the wild. And we now have a link with a spectacle bear charity in Peru, who's working on the grounds to create reserves and to research and to understand the issues behind the declining population and to act upon that. They're working with the Peruvian government. They're working with local communities, doing some brilliant stuff on the ground so that local communities buy into the need for conservation. So, yeah, so I think that's a good example of how conservation works for us with the exotic species that we have, that by having... species here at Noah's Ark, we are conserving the species, but we're also connecting with conservation organizations overseas. We're fundraising for them as well, and we're raising awareness so that everyone who comes to the zoo, every keeper talk they'll hear on a daily basis will talk about conservation in Peru and the need to do that. So that's the kind of more regular zoo conservation. But in addition to that, because we've got our farming heritage, we've also taken our farm animals in a conservation direction. So now we have rare breed cattle and sheep and goats and geese, and we've become accredited with the Rare Breed Survival Trust. And so that's a really interesting branch of conservation that also is fascinating for visitors. And we often find parents and grandparents are really interested to hear those stories of the rare breeds and things like the Suffolk Punch horses, which were, you know, the war horses and worked the land in Britain. And there used to be several million of those Suffolk Punch horses in Britain, but now they're actually rarer as a breed than pandas and than giant pandas. So we feel strongly as a sort of organization that has farming roots to play our part in conserving those rare breeds and this amazing social history that goes with that. And then the third area is to do with native wildlife conservation. So we have some brilliant conservation areas around the edges of the zoo. And we have surveys done. We monitor what is here. Quite exciting. Last year we had UWE came out and did some research, and they found we had 11 species of bats in one area of a beech coppice. And they also found a signal indicating there's hazel dormice there. So that's another kind of part of the conservation we're doing with the native species around us, because we've got this lovely big wild site.
Wow, loads happening. Very interesting. Thank you. I just want to talk about your work experience award and your work experience program that you have. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we really enjoy having work experience students here at Noah's Ark. And actually it's always been a big feature of the experience. I think you may have seen as a visitor, Kelly, that historically there used to be like loads of teenagers with orange t-shirts at the weekend, and they're kind of helping out in Animal Village. And when we came to the COVID period, it all had to come to a stop. So we really had a kind of rethink of like, how are we going to do this going forward? And so we've created a really great partnership with Western College. So now what we do is we offer work experience placements for the animal management course at Western. We take students on their work experience placements, and they work very, very closely, mainly with a farm animal team, where they have plenty of kind of hands-on interaction. And they end up being like really valued members of the team. We give them a fair amount of responsibility, plenty of guidance. We found that it's worked really well, and we were delighted when Western College kind of gave us that award in the summer, that they obviously feel it's working well, and the students are really, really gaining from the experience they're picking up here, and we're sort of equipping them with some real live experience they could take further, either into further studies if they want to go on and do a degree or higher education qualification, and then ultimately into the animal care industry.
So how many do you have? How many students do you have that come and work with you approximately across the year?
Across the year, it is about 20 or so.
Right.
So we've actually, in terms of the numbers, we're taking fewer students than we used to, but we're offering a really good quality experience. And that's kind of really what we're doing now. And I think that's what Western College have told us they value the most, is the sort of the quality of the training that they're getting. We're also working with Western with their SEN team. And so we're kind of looking to see how we can develop that work experience program and offer a wider range of experiences. And that may well go beyond animal care, because as an attraction, we have various different kind of strings to our business. So we have obviously the catering team, and then we have retail, and we have kind of customer service. So there's various kinds of experience we can offer. So we're sort of exploring that with Western College at the moment to see how we can offer that for SEN students and potentially other work experience too.
This is, well, it's important, isn't it? Because these are your employees of the future, and you being a kind of rural venue, then you need to have as many people as possible that you can access, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. We really see that, and I think we can see through recruitment. We're lucky that we tend to do well with recruitment, but it is becoming harder to find people with the right skills and the right qualities that we need to continue to flourish as a charity. So we absolutely see the need for us to commit to that and to be part of that training.
Mm, What advice would you do you have for anyone wanting to get into working somewhere like Noah's Ark, leading on from that?
Yeah, I think that's a question that's often asked to us by visitors, actually. Quite often people will turn up for a visit and they'll say, how do I become a zookeeper?
Yeah.
So I think for that particular part, we employ 28 animal keepers. So for that, we would always say, absolutely, do your animal management, do your qualifications. It's actually a very competitive industry to get into, to be an animal keeper. And so usually we are recruiting, you know, graduates who've done zoology or environmental science and also have plenty of experience as volunteers. It's really, volunteering is a brilliant way to get into that. And there are, you know, there's other training that people offer. So people usually enter as an animal keeper with a degree plus a year or so of experience. But yeah, lots of enthusiasm. I think the dedication to pick up those days of volunteering alongside studies, that always counts for a lot. And determination usually goes a long way too. But that isn't the only way to become a, you know, part of the Noah's Ark team, because we employ you know, more catering staff than we do zookeepers. Mm-hmm. And similarly, we have people doing all kinds of jobs who love animals. They're here because they love animals. They love what Noah's Ark does, but they actually really enjoy doing a job in customer service or in marketing or in HR or something which is not directly involved with the animals, but it really sort of helps create that environment where the animals and the conservation can all thrive.
Mm. Okay, thank you for that. Lastly, I just want to ask you a few questions about you and some of your favourite things to do and places to go. Just quick fire round. Where's your favourite place to eat in the West?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of new back to the West Country, Kelly, because I've only been back 4 years, and about two of that we were completely locked down. So
gosh,
it feels as though I'm sort of discovering things for the first time. But somewhere that I ate very recently that I loved was actually in Weston-super-Mare, and it's a place called Revo.
Okay.
And that is just brilliant, because what a stunning view you get from it. I think it used to be the Sea Life Centre.
That's right.
So it's kind of on the beach there. And yeah, I love the kind of lounge style dining, and the views were just incredible. So yeah, I love that place.
Do you know what? I love that place too. If you catch it on the right day, it is beautiful. It's gorgeous, isn't it? I totally agree.
Yeah, and good to go out of season as well, I think. Because you get all the kind of beach views, but if it's like hammering down with rain, you can just enjoy the views from the nice dry inside.
Lovely, lovely. And how about places to drink? I say coffee, drink, wherever, however you want to.
Well, I love coffee, so I love all the independent coffee places in Bristol. And actually, my son is a massive coffee geek, and he founded the Bristol University Coffee Society. So I always ask him for tips of where to go in Bristol. But the other place that makes me chuckle, I love just for the West Country Somerset character, is the Blue Flame Pub, which is just outside Nailsea.
And right.
My tradition is quite a kind of rough and ready cider drinking pub.
Yeah.
But they created an amazing garden during the lockdown. So there's this lovely kind of orchard at the back, and they have all kinds of local ciders there. So that's a great locals place.
Ooh, that's interesting. I've not heard of that place. I'm going to have to check it out now. And how about your favourite place to visit in the West?
Well, there's so many good places, and I admire so many of the independent attractions. There's loads of fantastic places, but I think my favourite is actually the Bishop's Palace Gardens in Wells.
Right.
Just love that it's like this, an incredible oasis. I love the fact they've got the kind of formal gardens, but they've kind of got wild spaces as well, and you've got the stunning architecture, and it's kind of right in the heart of Wells. So I have to admit that's what I love to escape to kind of get away from it all.
Oh, it sounds lovely. Yeah, I love Wells. Well, I've got nothing more to ask you. You've given me so much today. I really appreciate your time. And if anyone wants to find out more, obviously you've got the website. I'll put all of your contact details for Noah's Ark Farm Park in the Zoo Farm. I say that because I'm used to saying that. Noah's Ark Zoo Farm. Now that it is in the show notes. And is there anything else that you would like to say that we haven't talked about?
It's been great talking to you, Kelly. Thanks for the opportunity. And I can't think of anything else to say. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today.
Oh, thanks for sharing all your insights and well done on the awards.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. For all links to my guests, their businesses and the places mentioned today, head to the blog on my website, biz2els.co.uk. You'll find the link in the show notes. I'm aiming for a podcast every 2 weeks, but when life gets in the way, it may take a little longer. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever else you listen to ensure you never miss an episode. You can even sign up for my newsletter on my website to get a summary of the podcast as soon as it comes out. If you enjoyed the episode, please, I'd really appreciate a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find it. Get in touch if you'd like to chat marketing, and I'm on Instagram, LinkedIn, TikTok and Threads. Come and say hi if you see me around too. I'd really love to hear your thoughts on the podcast.